Okay, so where are we? We are almost done with the quantization of 3D gravity using Dirac's program. So yesterday we focused on the Gauss constraint. And we apply the Gauss constraint on, so we look at just a trivalent vertex with all outgoing edges. And if we applied the Gauss constraint on this vertex, what we get was the solution was the 3J symbol, which is related to the Clebsch-Gordan coefficient. And this is so what we call the intertwiner. And I think in the tutorial you add an intertwiner. So you didn't use the same representation because you work with spinor. But at the end, anyway, for a three-valent vertex, you found that the solution was the 3J. Yeah, so here. We got that, so this is characterized by the three representation, SU2 representation associated to these three legs and the three magnetic number. And so this is, so any, in fact, so I'm not going to solve this constraint on a more complicated vertex, so a vertex with more legs than this one, because in fact, especially in 3D, you can always go back to three-valent vertices, okay? And this, what is nice in this case with the three-valent vertices is that it's uniquely defined up to, of course, normalization. So if you choose that it's normalized, then you have a uniquely defined. So here it's an intertwiner, so from the representation G1 tensor G2 G3 to the trivial representation. Okay, so what does it mean now for our state? What is a state which is on, so which live on a graph which is invariant under the Gauss constraint? So now we can build what we call a spin network state. So what we call a spin network state is going to be, so if you look now at a given graph with edges and vertices, okay, then the spin network state, so on each edge now you have associated, as we have seen, the SU2 representation, and now you know that at each end of your edge, you have magnetic number. But now, when the Gauss constraint is implemented, this magnetic number are contracted with the intertwiner here. Okay, so all the indices are contracted now with here. So here you have intertwiner. So the spin network state is, of course, SU2 V, because V is the number here of vertices invariant function. And I'm going to write it explicitly in a specific case because, well, I could write it explicitly for an abstract graph, but it's just that here it's complicated because here you see that I have chosen the convention that all the edges are outgoing, okay? And so when one of the edges is ingoing, then you contract the other, it's with a minus, and it's the other magnetic number, okay, associated to the edge, so it's a bit, just with this notation I introduced here, it's a bit complicated to write a spin network state just for abstract graph. So I'm going to write it for a specific graph. We are going to come back on it when we are going to solve the flatness constraint. And so let's look at the, so as a concrete example here. We're going to consider the simplest 2D surface we can consider, so we are going to consider the two sphere, okay, as our canonical surface. And the two sphere is triangulated. The simplest triangulation you can find is four triangles glued together, like on the boundary of a tetrahedron. Okay. So we're going to work on a tetrahedron. So let's represent to fix notation. Like and in fact, so here I'm talking about a triangulation. So you know that the spin network is the dual of the triangulation. So when I'm talking about the triangulation, the graph of the spin network is the dual of the triangulation, but the dual of a tetrahedron is also a tetrahedron, okay? So I can here, what I'm going to represent is not the triangulation, because I'm going to decorate this graph with the SU2 spin here. So this means that I'm just going to represent directly the spin network, which is also a tetrahedron, okay? So here, if I'm looking at the tetrahedron with okay, so let's fix notation now. So you know that we need to orient every edge here. So I'm going to call this one, decorated this one with J6, this one with J2, and this one with J4. So this vertex V will be decorated with the same intertwiner because we have all the three outgoing edges here, okay? And then for the other, I'm going to have some sign appearing. G5, G1, and G3 is this one, and I'm missing, no, one. Okay, so I have my six spin here, which correspond to the six edges of my tetrahedron. Okay, and we have four vertices. So here you know that the kinematical Hilbert space of gauge invariant, so SU2 gauge invariant state, is going to be spined by what we call spin network state, which is the graph dual to the triangulation. So here I'm really representing directly the spin network, because it's since I'm considering a tetrahedron, the dual is also a tetrahedron. Okay, and so if now I write the spin network associated to this, evaluated on group element, so Ji here. So this can be written as, I will have some sum. And so for each vertex, I'm going to get an intertwiner, which is a 3J. So I have the vertex J1, G2, J3, so this one. Then I have the vertex G1, G5, and G6. Then I have the vertex, so it was this one. Then I have the vertex G3, G4, and G5. And the fourth one is the G2, G6, G4. So now I need to add the magnetic number. So for this one, you know what are going to be the magnetic number, because it's just all outgoing edges. So it's, if I'm calling them P, it's P2, P6, P4. And then if I'm calling the other one M, so let's do here. So for this one, P1 is also outgoing, G1 is also outgoing, but G2 and G3 are ingoing, so I have a minus M2 minus M3. Then for this vertex, G5 is outgoing, but G6 and G1 are ingoing. So I have minus M1, P5 minus M6. And for this one, this vertex, so G3 is outgoing, and G5 and G4 are ingoing. So it's...
Why do we have P's and M's? Does it matter?
Sorry, no, because it's, yeah, so it's going to be contracted. So just the name is not, it's sum over, okay? So here, the idea is really that if you remember on one edges, I told you that you have a spin, and then at each vertex, you can see a magnetic number. One is from the representation, one will more be the dual representation if you have this orientation. So here, it's what I call here. So here would be P2 on G2 and M2. Okay, and you are going to see that now we are going to, so here I'm just working on the vertices, and then it's going to be contracted with the matrix element living on this edge, okay? So here you can, it's, you can, if you want to remember, but at the end you don't see it because it, everything is contracted. So here it will be the M2 and P2. So I'm just finishing, so G. And then you contract that with, so you also have some sign coming out from just the fact that you are dealing with outgoing edges. So it's just minus one GE minus ME and the product on the E. So E here can take the value from one to six. And then you contract this with, and for each edge, you also have the contract, the contraction with the matrix element, so G E M. Okay, so this is your spin network, which is so SU2 gauge invariant. Okay, yeah.
I'm still not sure about the P's and M's in this case.
Okay, so. Do you remember what I explained about how you decorate only one edge? Okay. So now we, for each edge here, you could put the magnetic number in addition to what I represented here as the spin. Okay. And so here you will have P2, P4, and P6 coming to this edge. Okay. And here M6, M5, P5. And M1, and here it was, so M4. Okay, and, but so this is the representation before imposing the constraint. Okay, it's just the basis of our state, kinematical state.
So basically, these are what ends within that over there.
Sorry?
I mean, so the way you made M, J, N and over on that edge, you replaced N with B in the graph, in that category.
Let me finish and then you tell me if it's clear. So here P and M are magnetic numbers. So this means that on this edge they can take the value, so minus J, J, which are there, okay, just the magnetic number. So this is just the representation, the basis when you are talking about graph, okay, without the gauge constraint. Now, if we impose the gauge constraint on these vertices, okay, we have seen that this is going to impose that discrete magnetic number satisfies some relation and are going to be contracted using the 3J symbol here. Okay, so here, if, yeah, so if you start just with our basis, then you apply the Gauss constraint, so then you don't see anymore this magnetic number because they are contracted with the intertwiner at each vertices. Okay, so now instead of the decorated graph of a gauge invariant state, is just some spin and some intertwiner at each vertices, and you don't talk anymore about the magnetic number. Whereas before, and you're right, the base was the state, basis state were defined as B, M, and N. So a spin and two magnetic number. Okay? Yeah, so what is
I'm just trying to understand. So the intertwiner in this case is basically just saying how the graph is supposed to, where what is supposed to come in, what is supposed to come out, and their relations, right?
Just to come back. So I have chosen to to solve the constraint, okay, on a, so I show you that when you try to solve the Gauss constraint just on a vertex, on a edge, you don't get anything. When it's on a two valent vertices, you also get nothing interesting. So the first interesting case was the, for the three valent vertex. But then you see that I have some freedom, since we also have the fact that we are dealing with oriented graphs. So I have chosen this specific case to show you that then in this case you get this number, which is the 3J symbol. And what so then it's just that when you have a graph, you have to choose orientation. Okay, and you see that if this vertex, you can choose that all the edges are outgoing, then for the other, you won't have this.
Sure.
This option. So it's just that here, what I'm saying, telling you is just that the intertwiner, if you do the same thing we did for this case, when you are with the outgoing edges or ingoing edges here, you will get a minus sign here, and you also get this factor coming out.
Right.
But so it's not that the intertwiner tell you. But you can see, yeah. So if you have this formula and you don't know the graph, indeed you can recover what are the orientation. Okay, but here what was more our starting point here is to start with a graph. So we have chosen the orientation and then we get this result.
Okay.
But then of course, if just this formula is given to you, you're right that then you can deduce what does it mean in terms of orientation of it.
Because intuitively, the idea that I had of the intertwiner, I don't know if it's right, is that it kind of tells me, it's as if you have like an electric circuit and you have like information of, you know, what currents are coming in, what currents are coming out, and that they have to be conserved, this kind of thing.
Yeah, it's a kind of conservation, yeah.
Right, okay. And what indices are you summing over there in your sum?
Yeah, so here you're just summing over any P and every L.
Okay,
so yeah, in fact, even if you know the Einstein convention, you don't really have to write it, but it's here since we also have product and anything. Sometimes it's clear to recall where we are summing. Yeah.
What does this quantity actually mean? Is it some sort of an amplitude or what?
Yeah. So here it's just a state. Okay. And we are going to. So it's a state associated to this graph. Okay. So it's a quantum state associated to this graph when you have solved the Gauss constraint. Okay. And so now we are going to solve the flatness constraint. It's the next step. And also we are going to solve the flatness constraint on a specific graph. And we are going to focus on this graph again and show that indeed what you get when you solve the flatness constraint, you get only, so here we are dealing with the two spheres. So if you remember, it's a trivial topology. So you are not expecting to get many degrees of freedom. We're expecting to get only one physical state, a unique one, and this one is going to be the 6J symbol, which characterizes completely the tetrahedron.
How is the two-sphere flat?
Sorry?
How is the two-sphere flat?
Yeah, so here it's the two-sphere represents your 2D surface. Then it's evolving, okay?
Yeah, but it's not flat. I mean, if I can't.
Yeah, no, the 2D. What is flat is the 3D space. So you consider a 2D surface, okay? So how you can how can you
so
this is your hypersurface, okay?
Yeah.
So then of course if it's evil,
sure.
Okay, it's going to span all R3 as a, so here the starting we are in the canonical approach, okay? So we start with a canonical surface and then we see what is going to.
Is it obvious that
this
triangulation of two spheres
should
be exactly the same?
If it's obvious, but it's the first triangulation which is not yet. I don't really. I don't know, Paul, you have an obvious.
If you have a two sphere, how would you go about triangulating that with calculating it to come up with this?
Yeah.
Would the sphere be tangent inside? Like, can you see the sphere? Or
yeah, so the sphere is, I don't, yeah, it's difficult to represent here.
This is a dual. A big sphere would like enough triangles on top of it, and like what you get in the end is something which is a,
yeah, because so here you have
like
to see that you have some
covering the sphere.
Spherical,
yeah.
So here I represent only straight edge, but maybe you, yeah, if you are on the sphere, you have some spherical.
to the vertices lie on the surface of the sphere somehow.
Okay. So if you increase the number of triangulate, like you could like a coarse graining of the sphere, you could have like a greater polyhedron described.
Yeah, then, but
but
for yeah, it's not really interesting to look at it. Yeah, but
Okay.
So this is just a specific example. In the simplest case, we can look at when we the simplest hypersurface we can consider, and so this is the state which is gauge SU2 gauge invariant.
Yeah.
Okay, so we still have the flatness constraint now to impose to this state. Okay, so you know that the flatness constraint here is kind of implementing the dynamics, and so at the end what we should get is a physical inner product. So let's look now at the next step is the flatness constraint. And so for the Gauss constraint here, we really had the projector onto constraint, okay? And it was really a projector because P, when we applied P squared, it was equal to, again, to P. And what it was interesting here, simple here, is that the gauge orbit are compact gauge orbit, which is not the case for the flatness constraint, okay? So it's like what we have seen in the case of the parameterized particle. Do you remember that when we introduce this additional t variable, so the time parameter, okay, we have this time translation freedom, and then so the gauge orbit were not also compact, and so then if you remember at the end, so we build our we build our kinematical Hilbert space, then we had a constraint which was in fact the Schrödinger equation, the quantized Schrödinger equation, and then when we solve this Schrödinger equation, we have a state, and if we took the same inner product with this state, okay, you have some infinity, because we were integrating over the gauge orbit which was infinite, and so we had to determine what was the physical inner product, okay? And so in this case, in the flatness constraint, it's something similar because we also have a gauge with an infinite gauge orbit. And so we will have to introduce a physical inner product, which is different from the kinematical inner product. Because you see that for the Gauss constraint, so we're starting with the kinematical Hilbert space. We implemented our Gauss constraint, but then we can still work with the same inner product. We don't have any infinity going out. So here we will have to think about that. And again, the flatness constraint is a complicated function, okay? It's nonlinear function of the holonomy involving, again, derivative. So it's quite complicated to quantize directly, but like for the Gauss constraint. But the idea here is again to use holonomies to associate it to closed curves. And I already show you, so here we are not going to quantize it directly, but we're going to use holonomies associated to closed curve. And I already show you that you can write the holonomy associated to a closed curve gamma. Where here it was at the infinitesimal level, but this can be generalized, that you can write this as being equal to identity minus the integral of, where here we have the flatness. And now the integral is on the surface bounded by your curve gamma plus some, okay. So the idea here is that imposing the flatness constraint would demand that the holonomy around this loop is equal to identity. Okay, it's trivial. So here it's what we're going to do. We are going to impose that, and this means that H gamma is equal to, we use the delta on the group, means that it's a trivial element, and so the trivial element here is the identity, okay? Yeah, so just before going back to this example, to come back on this idea that we need to define an inner product, a physical inner product, here we are going to use, so for this, if you want more detail, you can go to have a look to Bianca's lecture note, especially that she's going to on the chapter on the parameterized particle. She's also going to define the inner product, physical inner product, using this trick that I'm going to give you. Now that, so here the idea is that if we consider two kinematical states, okay, and we imposed our constraint with a delta function, so these states are supposed to be physical state now. So this means that we need to consider the physical inner product. By definition, this is can be written as the scalar, the inner product between C1 and on the kinematical. Okay, we're here since we are working, if this is a projector, indeed, this square is equal to delta C. So delta C squared is equal to delta C if this is a projector. But here, since we are dealing with delta, you don't really want to take the square of a delta. So the way to implement this is to define this way. Okay, so this is what we're going to define. So now let's go back to our. So if you want here, you can see Bianca lecture note for the case of the parameterized particle to see how it works. In this case, we already deal with. Particle. Okay, so maybe I'm going to keep. Blackboard because so, and I'm going to write here because I want to use this graph again, okay? So we go back to our example. So we go back to the tetrahedral network. And so how many loops, closed loop, can you define here?
So it's, like you said, it's trivial topology, so you can contract any closed loop to
the
point. So there's only
there's nothing you can do, right? No, but here, yeah, but here we really work on this. So this spin network is fixed, okay? And then of course we're going to. So in this spin network, how many loops can you do? You have closed loop. So you have, how many faces do you have here? Yeah, so you have four loops, okay? So we have the eighth one, which is going to be, so. So I'm choosing an orientation here, okay? So G4 with G5, G6, so from, which one? Here, yeah, G6, G. Ah, it's one of the back, G5 and G4, okay? Minus one. Then, so this is the back, then I have. G6. Then H3, so I'm going to give them to you. And H4. Okay, so these are four closed loop by four holonomy. So to impose the flatness, then we could multiply the given state with four delta function. Like, so from we would get okay, we're here. Maybe I should specify the delta. Yeah.
How are you able to write H1? I mean, if you do you have to trace out the time through it?
Yeah.
As I mean, how is it G4 and what is C5, D6, H1?
Okay, so the H1. Okay, so when you apply this autonomy, okay, you start with J6 and J1 minus 1, you apply this, okay? So you start here with at this vertex, you can read it like this. And you go along the back face, okay? So G6, J5, and then J4, but you see that the orientation is different, J4 minus
2.
Okay? Okay, but so if we do that, in fact, we are imposing too many constraints. Well, it's not too many, it's that there is a, it's redundant here, okay? So if we do, if we impose this, then we will get a divergence in the inner product. So can you see why it's redundant? So, wait.
There is this law for like a closed surface that there is a relation between the edges of the loops and stuff like this that would kill one of these.
Yeah, so you can see that like this, but here it's explicitly given. You can read it explicitly by just the expression of the loop, and also indeed you can go around here doing a kind of closed loop and in order to get one of them. So the idea here is that indeed one of them, you have for example H4, can be written as the product of the three times another holonomy. So here it's going to be G, I'll let you check that, H1 minus 1, H3, H2. So now if this is equal to identity, okay, then H4 is also equal to identity. So this means that if we impose H1, H2, and H3 equal to identity, automatically H4 is going to be imposed. Okay, so we don't want to so we are going to impose only three of them, okay? So now we want to use what I just wrote here in the case of the tetrahedral graph. Okay, so we are going to consider the state, which is SU2 gauge invariant, and try to impose the flatness constraint on it. Okay, so we are going to consider two kinematical states. Cool. State. Which are based on our graph, and satisfying here the Gauss constraint. But not the flatness. And here I'm not I don't have so much time. I'm not going to give you all the steps. I'm just going to give you what we're going to write and what is the result here. And so for this, the physical inner product is given as so delta H1 times delta H2 scalar. So quite often in loop quantum gravity, we are going to talk about the kinematical Hilbert space, where the Gauss constraint has already been implemented. Okay, so whereas, yeah, and it's not very, it's just that it's so natural to implement the Gauss constraint that, yeah. So the physical inner product here, by definition, is given by H1 2 H3 on C1, where here we just use the kinematical inner product, so we're going just to use the R measure. And so. Yeah, sorry.
The thing that you said, like if H1 minus 1, H3, H2 is 1, that's an if, right? Or is it always going to be true?
No, if we, so the idea is that just if we impose these three constraints, so it's what we're going to impose now, okay? Then the last one is also going to be imposed automatically. So the idea is that if here you want to define this inner product and you add the delta H4, okay? You see that once these three ones are going to be imposed, you will be left with a delta.
Right, so each one of them is going to have to be one.
Yeah.
H1 has to be one, H2. All
that,
right?
Yeah.
So then that thing works.
Yeah.
Okay.
And the idea is just that since if you impose really the four of them, then you will be left here with the delta,
sure.
And so some infinity, okay?
Okay.
So that's why we don't. It's just because, yeah, it's imposed twice. Okay, so now what is the state I'm considering? So I said it's the one based on the tetrahedral graph, which is satisfying the Gauss constraint. So it's just the one we wrote here. So I'm just going to use some this notation. So as you've seen, it's depend only on the spin, okay, six spin. And here you can even forget about the intertwiner, because since it's only three valent intertwiner, you know that it's a Clebsch-Gerbert, okay? So you can just really characterize your state here is really characterized by six spin, J4. And so again, it's the same expression as before. So it's this sum over mi, ni, or pi, I don't know as you want, then minus one, where I go to 1 to 6 for the sign, and then you have your 4, so I'm not going to rewrite them explicitly here. You have the 4 3J symbol, and then you have this product of bases, the tensor product of G1, M1, N1 with until 6. So here is a 3J. Sometimes it's called 3NJ. Okay, and so we consider a first state and a second one. So state 2 is just going to be the same thing with different label. So J1 prime. Any questions? Or, yeah. J1 prime, J2 prime, five. Okay, so this is the second statement. So now, if I rewrite this, what does it mean? So this means that I'm going to call this integral here the transition. It can be seen as a transition amplitude between the state depending on the prime and the ji, okay? And this is an integral over six copy of SU2. Yeah, let's introduce some other notation, otherwise it's going to be too long to write that. So I'm going to call this the sine and the product of the four 3j as a kind of function which should depend on ji, mi, and I. Okay, so now I can formally write what I have here. So it's going to be a sum over the m prime I, n prime I of this symbol f and in fact, in the so not tomorrow because tomorrow I'm going to conclude on some geometrical operator and then on the 4D case. But then on Thursday we're going to see the spin foam model and we're going to see another way to introduce the sigj symbol because here the result we're going to get is some sigj symbol. So here you have the product from six of some matrix element for the G prime representation. So here it's Ni prime. And then you have the same thing for the M and I N. So again, from 1 to 6, and now it's a matrix representation in the spin J. So I'm not going to compute explicitly this integral, so you can find some details again in Bianca's lecture note here. Okay. Ah, sorry, and I'm forgetting the.
What does that stand for, trans?
Sorry?
What does it mean?
The transition amplitude between the this state and this state. Okay, so it just because you can interpret this inner product between two states between and this here. So
this is the formula there with like the all the deltas and the fizz and then the less deltas and the kin.
Sorry.
That's the formula up there above the phi one. But okay.
Okay. Yeah. So maybe. So here, once I have specified the level of my state, I can rewrite this between the label G prime. OK? Yeah, thanks. OK, so this is now this expression. And now I need to implement the delta. OK? So I have some delta H1. And then the product of the R measure and so what you get here are going to be product of some normalizing factor. So here the dimension of the representation. And here you have two sigj symbol. Okay, so the sigj symbol, I don't know if you already heard about it. I think you're working on the sigj symbol, no? With Rebecca.
Used to.
Okay, you already. Okay. Are you also familiar with this subject or? So it's come from just recoupling theory of SU2, okay? And really the idea is to So if you go back to the drawing of the tetrahedron here, so now you have intertwiner at each vertices, okay? And so which are sig J symbol or Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, and it's really the way you glue together this four Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, okay? Because here it's really what we have here, we have some Clebsch-Gordan coefficient and glued together in such a way that you get this symbol, which is really, as we're going to see, the physical state for the tetrahedron. That's it. And so here, what is okay, so for all this step here, the Bianca and lecture note if you're really interested in this calculation, but we're also going to come back on this symbol when we are going to deal with the spin foam approach, and it's going to be more clear how you obtain where this object comes from. But so here you see that in fact the inner product factorized. Okay, you can really factorize the J primes with the J. And so this really means that here you have that. See, the inner product between two states can be written as the inner product between and so this really shows that there is only one independent physical state, okay? So our physical Hilbert space here is one dimensional. And reflecting that, so the radius phase space when you deal with a spherical spatial hypersurface has zero dimension, okay? So here, here we have, this reflects the fact that we have only one physical state. And so let me write here the conclusion for this. So if you have here the physical state is really depending on, is really given so by defined as the inner product between and the delta, so the constraint. And so this is really up to some normalized factor, is the product of GG1 is 6, and then this sig J symbol so this is what we call the sig J symbol. So it's really come from some recoupling theory of SU2. So it's really just a combinatorial object, okay? Symbol. And it's really the physical, here it's the physical state. So in the spin network basis, basis for the triangulated two sphere. Okay, so what does it mean here? So this means that for a given topology, so we started with the simplest case, okay, where we consider that our 2D surface is two sphere here, okay, we solve completely the theory. And we get at the end one physical state, which is given by this strange symbol. So just to finish, so do you have any questions maybe?
Yeah, it's a kind of like a dumb question. So the holonomy takes values in SU2, that's what we said, right? But we seem to consider closed surfaces, closed loops on a hypersurface. So how can that be SU2 value? That cannot touch the entire group, right? Because on that hypersurface, you don't have full SU2, you have only have...
No, you have to, so it's, yeah, it's different from what is done in 4D, where you have additional gauge fixing. Here you can work on the canonical, your canonical analysis, you still work with SU2, okay? From the beginning, we are working with SU2, so you're right that here we introduce the, so where does this SU2 come from? It's come from the fact that we started with the metric, and then we wanted to, instead of working with the metric, we work with this triad, which is, can be seen as a small frame at each point of your manifold, and you have this additional freedom. And then we look at, once everything was written in terms of this triad and connection variable, we did the canonical analysis, but we still have this SU2 gauge symmetry here, okay? So we are not doing any gauge fixing as it's done in 4D. So that's true that in 4D, so if you really start with the first order action, you're working with, so SO4 or SO3, one, depending on if you're working in Euclidean or Lorentzian signature, and then if you want to go back to this Hdkar-Barbero variable, which are the equivalent here, they are SU2. So at some point, there is a kind of reduction. But here in 3D, you know, we are still working with this.
Yeah, well, there is a gauge in there in quantitative holonomy that I can always pull it back on some hypersurface. So if I think about the holonomy projected on one of these hypersurfaces, it shouldn't stay like a full SU2 transformation, right? Because what it uses is the F, which is also the full back curvature on that type of surface. So how can this give me anything that...
There are two things. When we are doing the canonical formulation, we are doing a splitting in the space-time coordinate. Okay, and here you also have the internal indices, and we haven't done any splitting or any gauge fixing here. Okay, so here what we did, even if we, when you do the (2+1) splitting of spacetime, then on our hypersurface you still have a SU2 connection. Okay, just restricted to in terms of internal indices, and so this is the fact that we have this connection that again, when we are doing with holonomies, so it's still SU2 holonomy. Okay, so here it's important to make the difference between. So the space-time indices and the internal indices. And here, when we did the canonical analysis, we only did a splitting in the space-time indices, which is different from the 4D case. So if you have the 4D case in mind, you're right that then in 4D we also fix the gauge in the internal indices in order to go to SU2. Because so what is the issue with the 4D case is that in the Lorentzian case, you are not dealing, the gauge group is not compact, okay? And so we don't really know how to do. So that's why it's really nice to work again with SU2, because then we are back to any method we know from SU2, lattice gauge theory, and anything, okay? So just maybe a word on... So I don't know if you remember, but at the classical level, but discrete level, I introduced another Hamiltonian function, okay, which was, so the idea of this Hamiltonian function was really at the discrete level to glue together triangle in such a way that this is embedded in a flat 3D geometry, okay? So I introduced this Hamiltonian, so it was just really the flatness constraint, or if you want this delta function, these loops here, but projected, if you remember, it was projected on the flux variable, okay? And so from this we deduce some Hamiltonian, what we could call the Hamiltonian function. And so we know how to quantize this Hamiltonian. And then what this Hamiltonian is going to give you, it's going to give you, if you apply this, so just to conclude, so we define some H, depending on the for each face and for each vertex of the face, okay, some Hamiltonian, just by taking any loop and projecting on the flux variable. So this can be seen as an operator, and if you apply this operator on a spin network, so this one satisfies already the Gauss constraint, then what you get is a kind of difference equation. You get a difference equation and on trivalent faces, and this equation is an equation which characterizes completely also the sigj symbol and which characterizes the symmetries at the quantum level which appear in the spin foam models. So what is interesting, so if you want to have a look to this paper, which was the paper by Valentin and Laurent, it's a nice paper which makes the link between so the spin foam approach and the canonical approach. And if you also interesting, because here you, so this approach is completely independent from the spin foam one, and it's, so in 3D we have the equivalence between spin foam and the canonical approach. So this, you can also see that on the paper by Karim Nouy and Alejandro Perez, which is called the 3D inner, well, I don't remember the title exactly, so maybe I can give it to you later. I will give it to to Denis, okay? The title exact of this thing, so because so it's quite interesting to they have shown really the equivalence between the spin foam approach and the canonical approach, and but this is not, does not exist in 4D, okay? So this is still a kind of open question, and so tomorrow we are going to see, to talk about geometric operators, okay? To see what is the, so in 3D we are going to talk about the length operator. And then I'm going to talk about the 4D loop quantum gravity case, okay? Like this, especially, I'm going to try to give you the vocabulary necessary to understand the discussion on Friday, okay, with people. So I'm going to tell you, I already know that someone is going to talk about this issue here, so I'm not going to talk really about it, but be aware that there is an issue here and stuff like this, okay? So the lecture tomorrow will be more to give you kind of rough picture in order that you be ready for the discussion on Friday. And on Thursday, we will talk about spin foam. Yeah?
So maybe a silly question, but is there anything that we did so far that would be, that would give you like a some limit, I don't know, semi-classic Mises equation or some kind of observable prediction? Like if the world was three-dimensional and this model was right,
okay, so here if you get, so from the sigj symbol, what you get, if you go to the semi-classical limit from the sigj symbol, what you get is the exponential of the action of, well, in fact, it's not the exponential, but it's the cosine, so there is a question about the...